Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
With Rod Oram this morning. Moreno, Rod, and Happy New Year.
Moreno, Rachel, and a very Happy New Year to you too.
It's lovely to have you back on the show and straight back into some big, big global situations. Let's start with the UK, which is, of course, your home as well. So you'll be feeling, I think, probably some strong emotions about what's happening over there at the moment, particularly with this new lockdown and the way the government is handling the worst spike in COVID that part of the world has seen yet. What are some of your biggest, initial feelings about this?
It's the continuing failure to deliver on promises and what's necessary. So, for example, the rollout of vaccines has been pretty chaotic so far. Meanwhile, this new strain of the virus is spreading very rapidly. The rate now is about 1 in 30 people in London have the virus. And so this has led to very severe lockdowns across the country and what's looking like very long-term lockdowns. So I think at this point, the social and economic impact starts to greatly increase.
Mm.
The UK economy was already one of the hardest hit amongst major economies by COVID and has recovered the most anemically. And then on top of that, of course, since we've now launched into the UK being outside the EU at the turn of the year, that is bringing a whole additional dysfunction to the economy on top of the virus ones.
It is one of those things where you can see compounding things happening. But where do we put blame for something like this? Is it in this particular government, or is this a longer history that's kind of led to this moment?
That's very hard to sort of pick a clear line through that. It's obvious that Boris Johnson is a very weak leader and is very prone to just saying and doing what's most convenient for him in the short term, the most politically expedient, rather than the most practical and the most urgent. But on top of that, it is a reasonably large country in terms of 60-odd million people and some real regional differences around the country. And I think that's greatly compounded things too in terms of not being able to easily get a strong support for measures that are required. So I think that's a problem shared by many, many countries, obviously not the least of which is the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like the States, there is something in the UK psyche, I guess, about being feisty and independent and sort of standing up for your rights. And so for some people, that is to be very disparaging of efforts to try and stifle the virus, but also not follow orders at all, willingly, if at all.
What should be some of the things, I guess, for us in New Zealand watching this happen, what do you think should be the biggest things we are taking from this? Because obviously we have this new strain of the virus at the border, and you know, we're having a lovely COVID-free summer at the moment, but the potential for there to be community transmission is always there. What do you think are some of the biggest, I guess, lessons or takeaways we should be taking from the UK at the moment?
I think the thing we've really got to focus on is keep reminding ourselves the situation we're in now and how good that is and why it is. And it's not just because of the border. There are other island nations which initially had done very well first time around on COVID, Iceland being a perfectly good example, a very, very low level of spread, and then a very early opening up to tourists, for example. And now COVID has run away from them on this second occasion and is with fairly high levels of infection there. So I think we've got to remind ourselves we can't just rely on being an island some distance away from everybody else and with a reasonably tight border. We've got to understand that if the virus crosses that border, it spreads very, very fast. And although we've now got better tracing than we had initially, we've still got to be very alert ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something that I'm trying to do is still practice some good behaviour, just to sort of cement that. Mm. So should the virus break out again, one can respond more easily. So I think it's really important to remember this hasn't gone away, and we've got to remain alert, and they've got to be practiced and skilled about the steps we need to really ramp up should it indeed break out again here.
Absolutely. Well, let's move to the US now, because that's also been a major context developing as we speak, but particularly since the insurrection riots in the Capitol. There's been some major moves from corporate firms to pull support for the Republican Party. What are your sort of, I guess, takes on this?
It's very interesting to see a wide range of corporates saying that they will stop contributing to political candidates who have been opposed to declaring the election valid. That's a good first step, but it's really highlighted the role that almost all U.S. companies play in political funding, mm-hmm. and contrasted them with a handful of companies that don't. So, for example, IBM has never in its history contributed to political campaigns or to parties, and that was a very strong position established by Thomas Watson, its founder, very, very long time ago. Mm-hmm. And yet IBM still has access to government. Its chief executive has been on CEO panels with the Trump administration. It still lobbies for changes of law, but in a very that it deems appropriate, but does that in a very transparent way, rather than political backing of individual candidates. So I think there's going to be a bit of a movement starting here, and I hope to institutional shareholder representatives would really get behind this to really make the IBM model the default one for mm-hmm. US corporates rather than be heavy donors. So I think it's a very significant shift. Right now it's only being billed by these companies as a temporary one, but if they start to understand they can still have political influence without needing to play direct roles in funding individuals in the system, I think that's a very important line to draw.
Mm, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit before we let you go, Rod, about what's happening in Hong Kong, and particularly the statement that's been released by other countries in the Five Eyes Agreement that New Zealand didn't sign on to, condemning some of the situations over there, particularly though it's been made a lot of that Nanaia Mahuta, who's our foreign affairs minister, did make a statement prior to this joint statement being released. But what's this whole context? Why is it seemingly a big deal?
This is the second time, the first back in May last year, when New Zealand didn't join the other members of the Five Eyes in a very strong statement against the Chinese government's crackdown in Hong Kong. Mm. And Mahuta's done the same thing Peters did at that time, which was to put out a pretty strong statement just on behalf of the New Zealand government. So now that we've done that now twice, and it's very hard to read quite what China makes of this. So China, of course, has been very strong in its response to the Four Eyes and has made no comment about New Zealand. And I don't. And it's very hard to read whether going it alone, as we're doing, is in a sense a sign of strength, that mm-hmm. we don't need to be in a gang of five to do that, or whether it makes us seem, from Chinese point of view, irrelevant in this, and therefore at this point they're not prepared to, they're seeing no need to respond to us. But it's some of the other countries, in particular Australia, have suffered some really significant trade reprisals from mm-hmm. Australia from China on this, it leaves an uncomfortable feeling about whether New Zealand is just sort of trying to have its cake and eat it, you know, still have that strong economic relationship with China without needing to be part of an international movement to be critical, and I would obviously, I personally feel it very legitimately critical of what China's doing in Hong Kong. Is it breaking international law in terms of the 1997 agreement between China and the UK of the return of sovereignty of Hong Kong to China? But of course, that's not the way the Chinese see it.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning, Rod. Plenty to get stuck into, and I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about next time we speak to you as well. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. We'll talk to you in a few weeks.
Thanks, Rachel. Talk to you then. Bye.
See you soon.
You just heard a bit of political commentary
with Rod.